Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
This is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast. We're recording this on Friday the 3rd of July, on the eve of the pubs reopening in England. And we're all very excited about that, aren't we?
Well, if you count petrified, yeah. Very excited in a very scared way. Yeah, I am not going to the pub this weekend. I don't want to go to the pub again until things feel a bit safer. But yeah, I'm not interested. No pubs for me.
Same. And I quite often can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. So maybe I'm feeling both.
Yeah. One of my guys I was talking to this week, Jason Kingdon, who's the CEO of Blue Prism. I'll come on to that in a bit. But he said quite an interesting thing. He said it's like, the possibility that you could go to the pub maybe does open up windows in the mind, was his phrase, which I was quite taken with at the time. But I'm very risk averse, so I'm not going anywhere.
No. I think the appeal of the pub is usually being able to have a sneaky pint when you're not supposed to be having a pint. And all of the controls and measures they have to put in place so you can enjoy the pub safely will just make that impossible for quite a long time to come. So until things calm down a bit, I've just got no interest in going to the pub at all.
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff wrapped around it. And I may be wrong, but I think the cover image for this week's issue of the Computer Weekly e-zine does lead on that. At least that was the plan from before. That's a story by Alex Scroxton about kind of privacy, people's fears, things like that. Although I can't remember that story in tremendous detail, so I shall say no more. Instead, press on to top line podcast today, what we're going to talk about, just to flag all that up. Claire's going to talk about her most influential women in technology. How would you describe it these days, Claire? Is it a program? Is it a list? Is it, because it's more than just an event.
Yeah, it's tough to describe because we release a list of the top 50 most influential women in UK tech, but we also run the diversity and inclusion event at the same time. So I guess it's a program, a list. I don't really know. How do you want to describe it?
It's certainly grown over the years, hasn't it?
So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I don't know how describe it. A program might be quite a good way of doing it, because it just seems to me to be a really big thing that we do and very important and so on. So it's whatever, however we describe it, it's a very important thing. So you're going to be talking about that in a bit. Caroline, you're revisiting an old favourite.
Two old favourites, yes. The loan charge and IR35. I've been charting the ins and outs of the finance bill, which has been passing through the House of Commons this week, which has had kind of implications for both those stories. So yeah, I'll be talking about that.
And I'm going to say a few words about AI and automation and human labour, so robots versus humans, so another old favourite. But more on that towards the end of the podcast. We can begin today with Claire and the influential women in IT. You've been long listing recently. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's really exciting, actually. So the putting together the list of the top 50 women in UK tech, it has sort of several stages. So the first stage is that there's nominations where Computer Weekly readers can put forward women that they know or think should be included in the top 50 list. That's one of the stages that's just ended. So we got the nominations in at sort of like the end of July. Then we have a panel of expert judges who look at all of the nominations as well as some of their own nominations, and then choose the shortlist for the 50 women in UK tech, which will then be released for a reader vote. And then the reader vote counts as sort of one of the judges for the final judging session, so that we can decide the order of the list as well as the winner. And so by the time this podcast has gone out, the voting should be available on the Computer Weekly website. But yeah, so we've just published the long list, which is all of the people that were considered for the top 50. The long list has gotten longer again this year. So I think the first time we published the long list, I think there were about 160 women on it. And this year there are more than 430.
430.
Which is pretty good. It's getting bigger and bigger every year.
Do you think that is like partly because obviously the event is growing in recognition, but also do you think there's like maybe a we're always told women, oh, they don't shout about their achievements enough. Do you think maybe there's a push towards maybe women getting more comfortable with doing that?
I hope so. Mm. I mean, if you look at all of the figures that we seem to see every year, it implies that there isn't a growth in the number of women in tech in the UK. But I think you might be right in that people are seeing the importance of standing up as a role model in the sector, maybe. And that might be like one of the ways that we can encourage more people in the future to join the sector, or to maybe like encourage girls to pursue it as an option.
Yeah, because we were talking last week about the numbers seeming to be quite static.
Mm.
But it sounds as though within that community, communities plural, there is confidence. That's what that kind of implies, I think.
I think that you get a lot of support. It never ceases to amaze me how much every woman in tech is totally there for other women in tech. So they'll constantly be putting people forward or tweeting them or supporting them or, you know, like congratulating them, shouting them out, commenting on other people's achievements and stuff. So it's a very supportive environment, and we're all here for each other. And I think that that's, you know, like really important.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And this, I mean, this kind of list and so on, there's a lot of work involved in these things, isn't there? It's tremendously hard work throughout the year to get to the event, which is in, I think it's October, isn't it?
Yeah, the online event is going to be on October 1st, and there are going to be a number of workshops leading up to the event as well. Details of which are yet to be announced. But yeah, I mean, I like putting the work in. I think it's a really important thing to do, but it does mean a lot of long hours sometimes when I'm sitting and, you know, like checking all of the job titles of women and checking that they're still working at the same places and putting together stuff.
And finding speakers and all that.
Yeah, stuff like that. I got a bit of help with some of the checking for the long list this year, considering that, you know, like there are an extra 100 women on top of last year, which was very welcome.
Yeah. Oh, 50 is a good number.
And well, it used to be 25. Yeah. When it was launched in 2012, it was only 25 women. And now we have a top 50 and a Hall of Fame and a bunch of rising stars every year.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really got very, very varied. Cool. Well, and that list is on the Computer Weekly website for everyone to have a look at. Cool. Thank you very much for that, Claire. Back in the swing of it.
All yeah, it feels hour. Like it, yeah.
Yeah. And Caroline, you're also back in the swing.
Oh. Yes. Back in the swing of all things to do with IT contractors, really. Yeah, and tax-related matters. Yeah, it's been. I've had a few weeks off it actually. Just things seem to have quietened down on that sort of news.
It feels like a while since we've discussed IR35.
Yeah,
I like it. It feels like an update. It's like following a soap.
It is. Yeah. It's it has been a little while, and. It's weird, as I was writing these stories, because I write so many of them, and a lot of the information is kind of, not repetitive, but you have to obviously write it in a way that, you know, if someone is coming to a story for the first time, they understand it, you know, but also if someone's in the thick of it, they don't feel like they're being kind of like hit over the head with the information. So a lot of the stories have the same kind of a few of the same sort of similar wording paragraphs in it. Mm. And I was sat down to write the IR35 on this week, and I was like, I've forgotten all about it. Like I've forgotten what my phrasing is, and I had to like go back and go, oh my god, how is this possible when it dominated so much of my life a few months ago that I now can't remember sort of some of what I'm supposed to be talking about, or I can't seem to write about it on any authority at the minute. So yeah, I've had to almost like revise and kind of cram and get back to like, okay, that's what it's all about. Right, brilliant. As part of that, I've spent quite a bit of time this week trying to get to grips with the ins and outs of the government's forthcoming finance bill, which has been about as much fun as it sounds. So at the moment, I'm not exactly sure when, I don't think anyone's actually exactly sure when the finance bill in its finalised form is due to drop, because, you know, we've got COVID, Brexit, and the world is generally in a state of disrepair. But yeah, the finance bill itself is basically a document the government produces where it sets out exactly how it's going to make good on all the proposals and promises that it's made during the most recent budget. So this one is quite, it seems, usually I think the finance bill only covers 1 year, but this year it's the 2019 and 2021 finance bill. So it's, I think they're just trying to cram everything in. So I just don't think anyone knows when we're going to get another budget, really. So at the moment, the bill is currently winging its way through the House of Commons, and I've been closely tracking its progress because it forms an important part of the two stories we mentioned earlier, the loan charge saga and the incoming IR35 reforms. And for those affected by both those issues, there was quite a lot riding on what was going to happen in the House of Commons this week. MPs were set to vote on whether a couple of amendments relating to both IR35 and the loan charge should be added to the finance bill. From an IR35 perspective, mm-hmm. the vote was on whether or not the April 2021 start date for the reform should be pushed back and delayed again until 2023-2024, because the world is on fire, basically. And everything, and yeah, with everything else going on at the moment, it's, you know, is it right that the private sector, you know, with respect to the economic challenges it's facing because of COVID, you know, should they have to get to grips with this quite onerous piece of legislation at the same time? So it's kind of geared towards, you know, should we give them a bit of breathing space, let the private sector get over the economic problems that that COVID could potentially cause, and, you know, before we hit them with this new legislation. But also there were calls as well that before the legislation comes in, there really needs to be a proper impact assessment about the impact it's going to have on contractors, flexible workers, and also private sector businesses as well. There hasn't really been that so far. So there's been kind of like, please, can we just vote for a delay so we can just get COVID out of the way and have a proper assessment of what's going to happen if we add this into the mix with, like I say, Brexit, COVID, everything else. So what exactly is going to change from April 2021 is that medium to large private sector firms are going to assume responsibility for determining how the contractors they engage with should be taxed based on the work they do and how it's performed. And that means from that date, they'll need to ensure that every single contractor they engage with has had their tax status individually assessed to ensure they're compliant with the new IR35 rules. And so that, you know, some of these companies, if you think of a large private sector firm, some of the financial services firms, for example, very reliant on contractors in their workforce, that, you know, that could mean having to assess, you know, thousands and thousands of people. So it's quite a big kind of administrative undertaking for these firms, which is why it's kind of like, maybe we should give them a little bit of a breather, like maybe delay the rollout for another year or two. So previously it was down to the contractors themselves to decide how they should be taxed. But according to HMRC, that system has been open to abuse, with contractors deliberately seeking to misclassify themselves in the interests of basically trying to minimise their employment tax liabilities. But as our reporting on this shows time and time again, that's an accusation the IT contractor community and all contractors, you know, very much refute. They don't do that, but HMRC does thinks to the contrary. So, like I say, there was an amendment tabled in the finance bill to delay the start date so that a proper impact assessment on the effects of the IR35 rules could be undertaken. But unfortunately, the vote didn't go the way that maybe the contractors want. So it's actually been decided now that April 2021, that's the start date. Businesses need to start preparing for that. There'll be, I don't know if there's any chance of any further delays, but a lot of the response we had to this vote this week was that, you know, companies can't afford to waste any time now. It's basically going to be, it's going to come into force in April 2021. You know, I don't think there's any other legislative path to try and delay it or anything, unless, like I say, we have another government intervention, because originally it was supposed to come into force in April 2020, but because of COVID it got pushed back 12 months. So unless, you know, the Chancellor does get involved, and just, you know, at the moment it's looking very much a definite. So that was that. Like I said, we've had quite a few disappointed people get in touch on that, and so we'll just have to see how things pan out. I mean, for me, it means we're going to have probably another crop of stories from IT contractors getting in touch with us saying our company has decided to respond to this news by axing all contractors because it's too much of an administrative burden. We had a flurry of those kind of stories last year, and then when the delay came in, some of these companies saying, oh, actually we do like contractors, can you come back and work for us? And it's, so we've got all that going on. So yeah, keep me in stories for a little while, that one. so that's not so much good news there for IT contractors. And then there was even worse news for anyone caught up in the loan charge saga as well on Wednesday night. Yeah, yeah. So 50 named MPs had supported an amendment in the finance bill that could have potentially helped thousands of people who've been saddled with life-changing tax bills through the loan charge policy. It could have freed them from it. But there was drama.
the people who, you know, like basically have had to destroy their entire lives to pay back loans that they didn't think that they would have to pay back, these people.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's an update on them. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, as previously explained on the podcast many, many, many times now, this policy is, the loan charge policy is geared towards recouping the employment taxes HMRC claims people avoided paying by opting at some point in their careers to be reimbursed for the work they did in the form of non-taxable loans. According to HMRC, these loans were never intended to be repaid, which is a point of contention, and so should be reclassified as income and retrospectively taxed, and the fairness of which is subject to huge amounts of debate, as Claire alluded to, trying to go into the ins and outs, so that would take far more time than we have on the podcast today. But the suggested amendment sought to tighten up the loan charge policy so that it would only apply to individuals who knowingly sought to evade tax by being reimbursed for the work they did through loans prior to the 2015-16 tax year. So a lot of the contractors I speak to who are caught up in all this were really banking on this amendment making the cut. And, you know, they had, like I say, the support of 50 or more MPs from across various political parties. And so it was kind of seen as like, maybe that's a really good sign that, you know, we will get support for this, the vote will go through. The onus will be then on HMRC to prove these people knowingly evaded tax rather than everything else. For whatever reasons, well, it's all quite complicated because I'm not a political journalist, but I don't really know masses about how whips work and all that kind of stuff. But from what I understand, there was the amendment didn't get voted on at all because there were sort of certain MPs from certain political parties who said they would abstain on the vote and they wouldn't vote in it anyway. And then other people who had to vote according to the whips. That's just what, like I say, I was getting this third hand from other people. So there was no vote on that at all. So lots and lots of very disappointed contractors out there who sort of saw this amendment as maybe being like, you know, at least, you know, a bit of hope that perhaps their loans might get written off and their tax bills and stuff. And before I got on the podcast today, I was in the throes of sort of putting together a sort of an article, sort of getting some of the reaction from sort of the IT contractors caught up in this, and but also looking at, you know, what's next for them. Is it just a case now of, as we talked about before, you've just got to find the money there's to pay this bill or declare yourself bankrupt to pay these bills and stuff like that? You know, what is the next course of action for them? I know there's obviously, we've talked about before, there's various campaign groups who are sort of championing this issue. So be talking to them about, you know, what they see as next steps, you know, just help these people out. But yeah, there's a lot going on. So I was thinking, you know, it's been a few months since we've done like a big chunk of reporting on this, and I think it's maybe useful to look at where we are 6 months on from our first maybe crop of articles on it. So that'll be what I'll be working on over the next few weeks. Like I say, it's been a while since I've covered any of this, and now I'm just jumping straight back in at the deep end with it all again. Yeah, I very much anticipate it will take over my life again. But, you know, it's a big, important topic, so I'm happy for it to do that.
Yeah. It was delayed, wasn't it, by Rishi Sunak? I think we discussed that on the podcast.
What, the IR35?
Yeah. The end of March, yeah. So yeah. There's some relief, but yeah, it's not panned out the way that the contractors were hoping. Mm. Yeah, I know they were angry with Rishi.
It's a difficult time though, because like I say, if you're an IT contractor and you're hit by the loan charge and you're facing up to these huge sort of life-changing tax bills, and at the same time a lot of the people we're talking to aren't working at the minute because of COVID. So you've got your means of being able to pay that back being sort of diminished by economic circumstances, and then possibly down the road you've got IR35, which might lead to, again, companies taking this sort of view that, oh, actually, we don't want to hire contractors anymore. You know, everything considered, it's a really, really sort of worrying time for the contractor community with all this going on at the moment. So much uncertainty. And I know there is for lots of people, but yeah, it's a bit of a firestorm, really.
Well, I think one of your sources says that hiring in a compliant way might become easier for companies because there's been a bit of delay. Some legal clarification and and things like that. So he seemed to have a little bit of
hope. Can't count the months off the top of my head. But yeah, there's obviously still a few months to go before the reforms come in, and there's really no excuses for companies not to sort of take the time to do these assessments properly, put in proper systems and stuff like that, given, you know, they've already had a 12-month delay and have had time to prepare. So yeah, hopefully we won't see another swarm of companies axe all contractors. We'll have to see how it pans out, but I say they are, to my mind, they have got the time to sort of do this properly, and they should make the most of it, really.
So I'm now going to talk about robots.
Yay! Our favourite.
We love a robot on this podcast. Or do we? So this week I did three interviews, which I didn't plan it this way, but they all kind of touched on AI and automation in different ways. So one was with the CIO of Autodesk, a guy called Prakash Kota. Very dynamic, very engaging, humorous CIO based in San Francisco. I did another interview with the CEO of Blue Prism, which is a UK company that does robotic process automation. In fact, they've got a pretty good claim to being the company that invented the concept of RPA, and a great British success story in some ways. Jason Kingdon, that is. And the third was with Nigel Shadbolt, or Sir Nigel Shadbolt, to give him his full honorific, co-founder of the Open Data Institute and principal of Jesus College, Oxford. And he's one of the kind of big thinkers and pioneers of AI research in UK academia, is Nigel, author of a book about AI and humans, The Digital Ape, which I have a copy of, signed no less. But I'll start with Prakash of Autodesk. So Autodesk makes software for people who design and build things, and they've been doing it for a long time now. And they've been moving their business model from distributing their software on CDs, DVDs, I guess, to online and SaaS. So that's their big picture, digital transformation from DVDs to online. So that's the main thing that's always on his mind. Now, Prakash loves to automate stuff. He said that we joked that, you know, when he's recruiting people for his IT department, he's looking for lazy engineers who'll see a process that's boring and repetitive and dull, and will automate. Their instinct will be to automate that process. And in terms of what they're doing as a company, they're using SAP Qualtrics as software to take some of the friction out of the relationship between their software and the users of their software. And they're doing similar stuff for employees, but I mean, that's just a kind of detail of that particular implementation. The main thing is he's a CIO who loves to automate. I mean, we talk about digital transformation, don't we, quite a lot, but I suppose one of the big aspects of digital transformation that makes it real is just the idea of automating stuff. Anything that was manual, automate it. Anything that's boring and repetitive, automate it. And then you're on your way to you're on your way to digital transformation, which is what he believes he's doing. So that's Prakash. So the second interview is with Jason Kingdon, who's the CEO of a robotic process automation company, RPA. Again, very humorous guy, very engaging guy. I think one of the nice things about our job is we do get to talk to, but not people who are just smart, but they're, because they've reached the positions they've reached, they've also got a bit of, you know, a bit of humor and charisma. And stuff. Anyway, they did a survey recently, which I didn't write up because, as I've said on previous podcasts, I really don't like vendor sponsored surveys because they're invariably self-serving. But anyway, I had a look at their survey, and one of the things that it said is that people like us, in the broad sense, so it's like knowledge workers, are becoming more comfortable with what Blue Prism would call digital workers, or robots if you prefer. So this is the stats. So knowledge workers with fears about job loss related to RPA in 2019 was 31%. In 2020, it's gone down to 26% of knowledge workers, which Okay, that's a reduction, but it's still a quarter. Still a quarter of knowledge workers are fearful about, you know, robots coming in and doing either all of our jobs or bits of our jobs. And I asked Jason specifically, being a very sort of self-centered person, about robots replacing journalists.
The nightmare.
What about that? Now, as we know, this has happened.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, it's been happening for quite a long time. You know, kind of financial results stories and things like that are things that have been automated by the big press agencies and so on. Now, he said, this is his quote. So he said, well, we can't shy away from the replacement of humans. I might be paraphrasing there, actually. But because, like, the digital worker, the robot, does consume other digital products. But, he said, we're still nowhere close to general human intelligence, though. So a robotic writer able to synthesize a story from different sources just doesn't exist. So the really interesting creative stuff, he says, is still the domain of the human. And we're nowhere near that in terms of AI. So, sigh of relief.
I mean, a robot might know if you were paraphrasing or not.
Yeah. Well, let's try and hang on to these crumbs of comfort, though, for the time being.
I mean, the thing that's always been said is that the stuff that's the hardest to automate is, you know, like the human emotion and the emotional intelligence, isn't it? So I guess the more of that there is in journalism, journalistic pieces, the harder it would be to automate it, I guess.
Yeah, and automate, definitely. And yeah, no, it's, I mean, he made that point about synthesizing, which I guess is more of an intellectual thing. You know, could a kind of robot journalist really be able to kind of synthesize things and bring things together the way that maybe Caroline's just been doing with those two things, the loan charge and the IR35 legislation and stuff like that.
On related point, there was quite a high profile AI journalist mistake recently, a group around Microsoft getting rid of its journalists and replacing them with AI. And then it turned out that these AIs were reporting on a story about the girl band Little Mix, who I am a huge fan of.
Yeah, and our colleague Ryan Priest, he wrote that one up as a downtime.
Oh, did he? Oh, I didn't see that. Sorry, Ryan.
His title was Artificial Ignorance. Classic Ryan.
That's why we pay him the big bucks.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, mixed up Jade and Leanne and Little Mix. But I might be wrong about this. I tried to check on this before coming on the podcast, but I don't think Microsoft has reversed its policy as a consequence of that mistake and decided that actually it's not going to make those journalists redundant after all. So this stuff is still happening, and it'll probably happen a bit more, which is one of the things that Nigel said, just coming on to him. So again, I put to him the scenario of, I didn't mention in particular, but like a media company bringing in a robot to write stories based on press releases and just kind of gutting through the press release. So how do we assess that ethically, I asked him, because he is a leading kind of thinker on AI ethics and stuff in the UK. And he made a similar point to Jason. So this is what he said. He said, routine automatic syndication has been around in financial services for years and will come more into news publication. But automated story writing will only take you so far. Things like, are you confident in your sources? Is this a story to pursue, etc., etc.? I mean, again, all of that is well beyond any existing AI. So, you know, another sigh of relief, maybe. And he also said that if we're, you know, when it comes to things like redundancy or maybe one company having an unfair advantage over another because it's using this sort of stuff, then you're getting more into the realms of labor law and regulation and things like that. And in general, he is a very big fan of the idea that AI, more automation, will expand the economy ultimately. and ultimately create more jobs and different jobs and things like that. I think I agree with that.
Mm.
But in the short term, you know, we still have journalists, but also like other knowledge workers like lawyers and analysts and so on being made redundant.
My concern would be that the jobs that are created once certain roles are automated won't necessarily be ones that would close any kind of like skills gap divide or leave behind people who might be slightly more low skilled than others. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And the other thing that I worry about actually is, to come back to that press release thing, the way we learn to do our higher order, higher value articles is by serving a sort of apprenticeship of taking a whole bunch of press releases and taking the bullshit out. I mean, that's a part of our training. And that will be true across lots and lots of jobs. Those seemingly mundane things, you have to go through those to get it to a different level. I don't know. I mean, I think in the long run, it's probably true that you are going to get more jobs. And the other thing that people always say is that it frees you up.
Mm.
It frees you up to do the broader strategic thinking stuff. And then, you know, like you were saying, there are swathes of people who, you know, maybe they're not going to get to those levels anyway, but the tasks that they're doing are being automated out. So I mean, I do agree with that. I think in the long run, but the long run could take a while. I don't know. What do we think? Do we think other aspects of our job that you would happily automate take out?
We talked about it a few weeks ago, but yeah, the use of Otter helping to automate quite a big bit of my transcription workload has been nothing but a blessing. Happy for that to be automated. Sometimes I just wish like my emails could just be automated, just to deal with, so they would just deal with themselves, because I just don't have the brain space to respond to emails, which if there's any PRs listening to this, they'll just know I'm just the worst at responding to emails. So if someone could just deal with that, like automation, or just that would be great if someone could just sort out my emails for me.
I'd like it to sort out what I need to respond to and what I don't, like relevant stuff and then stuff that doesn't apply to me. I would like that very much, rather than have to sift through hundreds of emails.
And the thing that's my kind of bugbear, I was speaking about to an American colleague about this too, is our content management system, which will be the same problem for everyone using a content management system, not just ours specifically, but there is a bit in the process where I'll be interested to hear if either of you agree or disagree with this, but you know, when you're selecting channels for your story, if you just press a button,
scan the words and then associate appropriate channels.
So because just for listeners who don't understand, the channels help direct on the website where our stories will turn up. So if you're interested in diversity, Claire will tag her stories in the diversity channel, so they all appear under that tab. But yeah, it's a really laborious process going through and, oh, actually, this story does stray into this area, so maybe I should add this tag, or maybe I should add this tag, or accidentally I've added this tag when it's not relevant, and your stories just go everywhere. It's just a mess. But yeah, if we could let's get a robot in, sort that out. Yeah, let's action that. We've decided on the podcast today. Let's overthrow the CMS.
But I thought, I suppose to make that happen, maybe one of us would have to, you know, get the software, learn how to do it, and kind of skill ourselves up in that way. So, like, I suppose what the general point I would make from that is maybe that's the way to do it without making people redundant, is to actually involve the staff in scaling up to say, oh, I identify that task as something that we could automate, so let's do that, you know, rather than imposing from above. a fiat, the way that's happened to other people that we know of. So we haven't been replaced by robots yet. Next week, we're taking a break as summer begins to roll on, and so on. So just taking a little bit of a break. So on this occasion, it just remains for me to say thank you very much, as usual, to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you very much to you, listener, for listening. And stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.